Describing the two-rotor engine.
Yeah, the two-rotor Corvette was a beautiful car, but it wasn't deemed to be in the same image as previous Corvettes. It was down in power, and it wasn't a big honking type Corvette, large bore displacement, go like hell, a vehicle that that the Corvette wanted to be. Yeah, the rotary engines kind of went by the wayside, and I believe that was about the time that the retirement of our president Ed Cole. He was kind of the father of trying to get that engine into production.
Mm-hmm.
There's a parallel there. There have been a lot of electric cars running, but when Pete Estes retired, then the electric car program kind of left too. So there's a little parallel.
Each president had a pet project, and when they left office,
Probably.
Joe Moore never really seriously considered the rotary engine after.
Not really. There were some real problems with the engine at that time. One of them was tip seals. After a few thousand miles, there'd be a great deal of wear, and it'd pass oil and it'd smoke, and evidently that's kind of solved with Mazda's engines, although I don't know how. I don't know what their long life is. You know, our V8 engines and our 4s now and our V6s will last hundreds of thousands of miles. Out here in the West Coast, people think nothing of buying a car with 110,000 miles on. They expect it to go 200, maybe at the most of the valve job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long the rotary engines last.
They only use them at the top of the line, though, at the top of their sports car line.
Yeah, just their sports car line.
The RX-7.
RX-7, yeah,
seven,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this bid to Opel, if I remember correctly, this happens to every young and upcoming designer in general motors. You've got to take your turn at Opel. At least they feel that not only is it part of your rounding out your design education, it feeds fresh blood into the Opel line as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they come about? Who approached you?
Well, it happened. I can't remember how it happened. Dave Holes, who was director of design at Opel, H-O-L-L-S, visited design staff. You know, when you're over there, you have to come back every few months to see what's happening and to show what you're doing, etc. He came and said that I was a contender for the job, and Bill wanted to know how I felt. Bill Mitchell wanted to know how I felt about it.
Right.
And I said, well, why doesn't he ask me directly? And he said, well, remember they asked you to take over that Vauxhall job as director of Vauxhall. And I went on vacation, and nobody had called me, but somebody else had accepted it. So I came back, and I said,
"Who was that?"
Oh, that was a year previously.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I made it known that, well, next time something like that comes up, I think it had better be handled a little different. So.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't Bill's fault. Somebody'd screwed up. So he'd asked Dave to ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And I
so
said,
he
well.
He had a couple of refusals, too, at least one.
Yeah, I know that Herb Rubicki, you know, initially when Claire McKeegan went over,
mm-hmm.
Had refused.
Right.
And
Claire
went in his place, that's right. So, and so, you know, not everybody wants to do something like that. It's it can be tough on a family because it's a whole new social order. They're doing things all over in a different way. You're moving everything, kids, dog, everything.
Have you switched that?
No, it's going.
What do you think?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
no, no, no, that's good. Good point, because I got to add more on it.
Yeah, you'll probably do a little wood shedding next few days.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt your commentary there, but did you look forward to the assignment?
Yeah.
How did you look when you went over to the assignment?
Well, first of all, in order to find out a little more about the job, Alex Cunningham, who's since retired now, was running Opel with Dave. Dave was the chief designer and director, and Alex Cunningham was over for a dinner, and I was invited to come along. And
in
Michigan.
Yeah.
And I invited Dave and Alex Cunningham over to the house one night. And we sat around discussing this possible move.
Mm-hmm.
and he was kind of wanted to find out about how I felt about vehicles, European vehicles and everything else. And we had a long discussion, deep into the night. And I remember that there was an empty cognac bottle and brandy and something else laying on a counter the next day. But I was awakened by my son, who was on a weekend, so it was on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. He said, "Dad, are you up?" I said, "Yeah, you know, one of those." He said, "Was Dad, was that your future boss?" I said, "Yeah, could be." He said, "Dad, I think you blew it."
How old was he at the time?
He was 14. The point was that Cunningham is very candid, Dave's very candid, mm-hmm. and so is I. So we had a very good time.
No nonsense.
Very. It was constant put down, too. It was not a boss or teacher-student relationship. It was that sort of thing. And that's one of the things that I liked about it. There's a certain degree of autonomy with that job, freedom to do something outside of a system as large as General Motors is, a design staff. That is a very large, cumbersome system where when you get with Opel, they produce sell a million cars a year, but it's more of a straight frontline outfit, which gives you an opportunity to move quicker with product.
Yeah.
And so
was that,
we accepted.
So it's a testing ground for you? Or?
Oh, it was kind of an interview, I guess.
Yeah.
but I think that Bill Mitchell had already said that I would do it, and I had accepted. So this was a follow-up more than anything. So we got
they
to know
each other. They were bringing you up to speed, too.
Yes,
what was happening there.
Right. And when I was in Paris, I stopped by to see Alex, and fine, we're all excited about doing this thing. I had a tour, and... of the building, and nobody was to know that I was to come yet.
No.
A lot of people guessed it. Some
of
designer friends guessed it. It was for a 3-year period. When I arrived there, Alex Cunningham had been promoted, so he wasn't even there.
Oh, no.
So he became head of all of overseas.
All overseas. Yeah.
Right. And
but Dave Halls was still there.
No, yeah, well, I replaced
him.
That's
so
right.
He stayed on for a week or so.
Yeah, right. And
I'll be nice.
Oh yeah, real great. Knows cars inside out. And so he, when he left, I started my thing there, and that was a wonderful experience.
What problems did you have? Did you come in on any problem area? Were there new models to be done, or
yeah,
there
were economic problems in 74. I started in 74, and. We'd just come through the World car, the T car, the Cadet,
mm-hmm.
and we shared the same design here and even as Zusu in Germany.
K-A-D-E-T-T,
yeah.
That's been your bread and butter car, small car
yeah,
for a number of years.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the year after, or during the year that I was there, the new Rabbit or Golf
mm-hmm.
had come out, which is front-wheel drive, and I remember being on a midnight road test with that car and our competitive cars, and it was a little bit of an earth-shaking feeling knowing that here we had the old product and they were going gangbusters with the new.
Mm-hmm.
But the Opel was very unique in that you don't design cars the same way as you do here. Here it's a trendy fad sort of thing. There it's all functional business, a lot of the Bauhaus left over.
Oh, really?
In fact, it in a way, it's closer to what the Corvette Camaro was in that there was a purpose to those cars.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you take the middle of the line, Buick, Olds, Pontiac at that time, the idea was to sell cars, not the function of the car, not necessarily the consumer, but a marketing, it was a marketing tool for itself. In Germany, it's very, very, the products put together so carefully that we got down to studying the cost of the paint and the spreadability of the paint, how many mils thick it was, and the cost of the pigment. And if anything was up several pfennigs, you didn't get the paint unless you had a merchandising scheme to sell it as an extra cost and see how much revenue you could pull back in. So it's a very, and then the weight analysis, finite element structures. It's a very, very demanding system, and it was a damn good experience. I wish everybody had that experience to go through.
Mm-hmm. Did you have problems with the language?
No, all the meetings are conducted in English. Now, we boned up. We had a German cassette player that we go skiing a lot, so before we went over for about 6 months, we even took it on ski trips and spoke German to ourselves and German friends. Inevitably, we had a lot of car friends in Europe. We'd come in, we'd start speaking German, and they would immediately want to speak English because they had no one to practice their second language with. And most Europeans speak 2 and 3 languages. So it was great, it was easy. We had some problems, but as long as we extended ourselves and tried the first sentence or two in German, whether you went to a library or you went to the butcher or the bread maker, wherever it is, they would look at you, they know you're trying, they'd smile, and then start speaking English. And you'd feel frustrated, but then you say, well, this worked well. You know?
You probably had, at most of these overseas operations, have a professional cadre of engineers, designers, model makers, who probably said, oh my gosh, here comes another director from
Well, you don't know that that's happening until they get to know you after a while, and then it comes out if you go out to dinner or something, a party or something. And you see, all the staff was assembled by Claire McKeegan when he was there.
Oh, really? He was really the architect?
Yeah. He was sent there to put the building together and do all of this.
Where had it been previously?
There was none.
But out of the Opal factory?
There was a loft up there, and they did some sketching, and they got designs from Detroit, and it wasn't a European car.
And that was in Frankfurt?
That was in Russell.
Well, but a different area.
Yeah, right. Right in the factory in a loft. And one of the criticisms of Opel was that people believed it to be an American company by the product because it had scaled down American designs. So the intent here is to let the thing become German, to supply the German populace with another choice.
Yeah. So the idea was to bring in the Isuzu connection, which worked out very well.
Oh, that worked during my tenure there. That was a business decision to get towards World Car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was some contract work that was done where we found out that Isuzu could do a front wheel drive transmission transaxle engine,
mm-hmm.
a hell of a lot less expensive,
yeah.
and it was the right engine, so it was a mutual contract.
One of the earliest and probably one of those most durable.
Yeah.
Those early Opel Isuzus are still driving around Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's a cadet.
That's
the World Car.
Okay.
I thought you were talking about the next generation where we did a lot of work with Isuzu on components too.
Well,
we started designing just passenger cars for Germany and the 13 countries where the German dealers were in Europe.
Right.
And then Vauxhall was designing its own vehicles. As we progressed through this cycle of reorganization, Opel Design became the center for European passenger car design,
mm-hmm.
all the European passenger cars. Including Vauxhall's or design. There was a rationalization of simplifying the product line.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time also, we had to work with suppliers to drive product costs down, and Isuzu was part of the GM team, so
uh-huh.
the new front wheel drive engines and transaxles found their way into the new front wheel drive Cadet,
mm-hmm.
which replaced the one you're talking about, the Isuzu.
What was the nameplate on that?
Cadet.
Still Cadet.
Right.
Uh-huh. Have you kept the Cadet?
Yes, that's
still
going.
Still your
right.
small car.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And
the interesting thing about it was at Opel, it's so well organized because you do a vehicle, they have basically 4 lines of vehicles. You do a vehicle 1 year, and then you do the next one the next year, and then you cycle all the way through. They have, from the bottom end, they had the Cadet. And then they saw a need for a subcompact car, which is the Spanish car. It's built in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
They put up a plant in Spain. We contributed to that. And that car is the Corsa, which is smaller. It's an S car or Corsa, Corsa.
What is the Spanish derivative of that? I mean, where does that derive from?
Don't know. it's not meant to be Spanish.
Oh, I
it's
see.
Just built there.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Cavaliers that we know here, I don't know, the J cars or J car Cavalier, they have a counterpart in Germany that we worked on as a world car through Vauxhall here, Australia, and yes,
yeah.
And then the Manta, which is another rear wheel drive coupe. And then there was the...
wasn't there a Monterey, M-A-N-T-A-R-E-Y, R-E-Y in the old Corvette series?
Yeah, right, there was. Right. And then the, I don't know if you know, if you're familiar with the Monza, a European Monza, and the Senator. They're the high-end cars.
Tell us a little bit about those.
Well, we had fun with those because this is the first assault that Opel had really to get a European sedan. It was a six-cylinder engine and independent front and rear suspension and very classic. Well, those two little models on the top are the Senator on the left and the Monza on the right.
I wondered because I couldn't recognize.
Yeah, they're 130 mile an hour vehicles. Mm-hmm. Six-cylinder engine, very smooth. They feel just like BMWs.
Mm-hmm.
They're really good.
Mm-hmm.
And we've sold a lot of those. At about that time, GM got a good image overseas for being able to design and build something that well.
But was it demonstrably a German car?
Yes,
rather
absolutely.
Rather than a facelift from Detroit.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And it was designed on site for that market. And Irv allowed us to do that.
Irv,
yeah, right. And actually, Dave started doing that with the Manta.
Mm-hmm.
And we started continuing that European feel. So I was supposed to be there only 3 years. I was there 6 years, so I was privileged to be able to do a whole model cycle and then the next one, which is really ideal.
So what problems did you have? Were there any crises, any real crises?
There were political...
The various worldwide marketing problems and design problems often.
There were problems in GM management getting off a plane, just viewing an audience of American cars coming in convoy,
mm-hmm.
and being driven right into the Opel Works and trying to put on their European hat, not understanding.
Yeah.
So we would have to sometimes debrief them by arranging to have a flight come in so they'd take a nap first. And maybe drive them through a certain part of town or get to an auto show or something first and then come and see us. So you had to do that because things would be taken out of context. Now we're over that hurdle, but that was a big thing in the mid 70s. That was very difficult.
You still had to have Detroit's concurrence
in every
major modeling
engineering
design.
Yes. Because Adamopol is a subsidiary of GM, and they have to make profit to pay back, you know, to exist. So they're very concerned.
Mm-hmm. And has it been profitable over the years?
No, it really hasn't.
It hasn't?
It's
been a problem.
Well, I think it's the organization. You know, they reorganized both Vauxhall and Opel to get back to have a single source management.
Mm-hmm.
So they've reorganized now that they're going to exist in Switzerland, Geneva.
Really?
All the top managers are going to be there.
Will be separate from the influences of the three.
Right.
And
from local problems, too, mm-hmm. because people tend to want to be perhaps too German and not enough European.
Mm-hmm.
They are influenced by the labor union, which has to, if it's a German company, has to sit on that board.
Mm-hmm.
It's a legal thing. So the many ramifications
local
are
content.
Local content and... Ford did this many years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
Now the problem with overseas is that if you can be leader in the market with only 10-12% of the market, so because there's so many manufacturers. So, but yeah, they make money, but not as much as they should. You know, it's a very very competitive area. But the cars that were done there are every bit as good as cars that we do here, and the hope is that a lot of that input will eventually make itself available in our products because
from a design history standpoint, did you find you were reasonably adaptable? You didn't come with preconceived notions of what the car should be, or you weren't told. Did you come there with a fairly open mind and a fairly flexible approach to European design?
Well, I'd like to think that I did. I guess I always had an affinity for the smaller cars,
right.
Corvette, Camaro, Chevy 2. I really didn't like the larger cars, so as far as an entry into that society, I was comfortable with that,
right.
Designing within a limited number of centimeters or inches.
And your European heritage?
Yeah, but there weren't many cars in Norway. They mostly horses, and so it didn't matter, horses and boats. But that wasn't as important. I think when someone goes over, the best thing you can do is keep your eyes and ears open and listen an awful lot, because I picked up an awful lot from the studio heads are there,
sure.
Who, and getting back to the previous subject,
yes.
The studio heads there that were formed, were put in place by Claire McKeegan, were still there,
mm-hmm.
Yet they'd seen three directors come and go,
mm-hmm.
McKeegan, Jordan, Holes, and now I was a fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem here is, when McKeegan was there, it was a father image.
Yes.
They were younger.
Mm-hmm.
When Charlie came over, it was still there, but he was a little younger. And Dave Holes, it's getting closer in age. Now, Dave and I are the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And now the people there are only a few years away. So they have a feeling of being teachers rather than being true participants, until you can get them on board. So the idea there is that you really have to give them their head, because they do have experience, they
right.
know the European market,
right.
And the best thing you can do is work with them to try to go farther. If you come in with a big stick, they'll break it on you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't
right.
get anything done.
Yeah.
And the same goes with working with the engineering force over there. They have a system that doesn't allow for any mistakes. So when you come up with something, you have to quantify. You have to give reason for design.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of these, I like it because I'm a stylist. It doesn't cut it. It has to be reasonable. Oh yeah. It's the Bauhaus mentality,
mm-hmm.
and it's not all bad.
Spell Bauhaus.
B-A-U-H-A-U-S.
Capital B.
Capital B, yeah. Now that's tempered now, because design does change as far as acceptability of Bauhaus thinking because of the Japanese influence. Some Germans said that the Japanese will never score inroads in Germany, yet right in Rüsselsheim there's a skyscraper went up that says Mitsubishi on top, you know, skyscraper, four or five stories tall.
Right, yeah.
And so there, now we have the Bauhaus direction, now we have to talk about entertainment and functional entertainment, instrument panels that light up but are still functional, and then we talk about value for money too. So things are changing, and the most perceptive people there are the studio chiefs, because they recognize that. It was a very exciting time. I
6 years. That's
my
wife.
Anyone
had that.
Yeah, that's the longest.
Was there a reason for that extension?
Well, I don't know. I like to stay.
You weren't unhappy about staying?
I wasn't unhappy, no, not at all, because there was the autonomous feeling, and you have a good group. You get to know the group, and you can work well with them, and engineering, and there's something happening that you can get a hold of. You're really responsible, and if they don't sell, then you take it. But it worked out well for us. I think the other thing is that at that particular time, there's several critical times in that assignment. One was, I think, Opel management was wondering if they sent me back, what were they getting? In the past, Bill would just send somebody, and that was it.
Sort of an obligatory tour, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he defined who it was, who he thought, and there were no appraisals or anything else. You just go, that's it, kid,
right.
You do it. The management at Opel became a little more sophisticated, and they wanted to know more about what was going to happen. They wanted to know what was going to happen to me when I went back. in the past, everybody went back there, they weren't told what they're going to do until they got there. Opel resisted that a little because if I wasn't given a good job going back, it'd be a reflection on anybody coming over. What would that person do? So there were many things into this. There were also some cutbacks, and frankly, there wasn't room for me back there at that particular time.
Because of the salary.
Yeah, so there was, and when you put this into perspective, if you take a series of men and transfer them into another facility, there's only a certain number of promotions that you can give going back because the top is full. So what do? So that's a kind of a management decision on how you handle something like that. And while they waited, I wasn't unhappy continuing that job. It was great.
Yeah, how'd the kids like it?
Oh, they loved it because they were in international school.
Yes.
Both of them ski like, they dance on skis, you know,
really?
And they had volleyball tournaments in England and France. They went on skiing sessions in France, Italy, and Germany, so they got to be international travelers.
How about Ellie Hunter?
She loved it because she was deep into sculpture and art, and you're surrounded by art and sculpture, and it was kind of a calling card to society because but to the social events around,
right.
Because if we were interested in art, we'd be invited. And of course, we're deep into car clubs too, with vintage racing, and we had many friends there too. Raced at
venerable tradition there,
right.
For you to jump right into
right.
Racing. Yeah.
We had times at Nürburgring and down in France. They had annual Bugatti Ferrari meets rallies. You know, you put your car on the open highway, and every rally stop, they had a glass of wine and cheese for you, and you went on. And it was a very, very good feeling of life.
Was Opel into competitive racing in those days?
But it was rally racing, and it was a little under the table. Rally's a big thing there.
Yeah.
There's still tight money in that area. Tony Fall he had his own racing stable in England, racing Opel cars on the side, but they hired him at last, and he's running their whole group. He's coming here next week, but that's still active.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be on vacation, so I'm going to miss
it.
It's terrible.
Yeah. So you got involved at least in extracurricular clubs.
Oh yeah.
Racing for the division for Fred.
Yeah, well, I just did the club racing,
yeah,
just
right.
With a Bugatti and an old Ferrari, but we attended a lot of the Formula One races, and it was great. It was really terrific.
I suppose this is a tough question to ask. What was your proudest achievement? If you look back, I'm most satisfied. In design terms.
I think our greatest was the Senator.
Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah.
Well, the car that it was to replace is really an American V8 engine, heavy car that looked like it had been designed in the States. And
the last of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea here was to build a real true European sedan. The difficult part is trying to convince your management back here on what that is. And because subtle little nuances there mean an awful lot there, and this is a different audience here. So you're dealing with a client who's not really into the audience that he should be every day. It's easier to design an environment. It's very hard to criticize when you're in another environment. So the idea of putting that together. The other thing that was great was we found a way to do the car and meet the budget and make this a really true European performer. And that meant an awful lot of compromises between the engineering department and design department. And as it turned out, everybody was happy. And that's why I considered a very good achievement.
Were your professional colleagues, the Germans, were they happy at last to be doing something?
Absolutely.
Oh,
they were just pleased. That's what made it so special, because they had a chance to exercise their tastes.
Right.
And we would try to guide it, try to extend their talent to make them go far enough.
What did the Senate center involved too. By the way, why the name? See the un-German name, isn't it?
Well, the old one was a diplomat.
Okay.
So it was. They took that sort of thing, and then they also gave those cars to certain members of the German Parliament as to try to break the Mercedes crowd. But that's still difficult. You know, as long as you sell cadets, it's very hard to sell senators.
Yeah. But so how did the senator into what kind of vehicle? Suppose what happened.
Well, the diplomat was the old vehicle with American components.
Okay, fine.
This was all German. They took a simple, straight, inline, six-cylinder engine, but the way they prepared it, it'll run all day at 130 miles an hour. It won't burn a bearing. And then they put it on special shock absorber mounts, engine mounts, so it's smooth and clean, independent rear suspension, it handled like hell. We're allowed to do its own alloy wheels that really look good.
Mm-hmm.
We found that there was no capacity in the plant for seats for this thing. So we approached Recaro, the best German seat builder in the world. Recaro.
And that was. Was the use of a well-known, presumably well-known Europeans into Carbus in the United States, was the use of a custom seat company like Recaro one of the first instances of that in a mass-produced car?
I believe it was, and it solved our problem and gave Recaro great credibility as far as a producer of mass production.
Yeah.
It met our cost goals, and even today, when you read Ford advertising, they say we tested all the great seats in the world, and the one that they found out was the best was the Opel Senator seat.
Yeah,
it's a Recaro
right.
seat.
And they use it, yes.
So it really is good. And we've driven that car down to Monaco and back several times. We have some friends down there who are in the Bugatti Club,
mm-hmm, right.
And we do it nonstop. It's so comfortable, and the car just hauls away like crazy.
What was the price range?
That was rather expensive, and I don't know what the D mark is now, but it was up there with just below BMW and just Mercedes. It was, the big series.
Yeah.
So it was expensive.
Yeah.
It's tough competition. Yeah, right.
30, 30.
To bring it over here to be between 20 and 30.
Has it ever been successfully imported to this country?
No.
Was there ever any?
There's been a lot of talk about marketing it here. But it has to go through the bumpers and the engine emissions. All
are standards a bit lower over in the continent?
They were then, but not now. Some of the forests are dying from pollution, and now they're talking about catalytics, and they're not in a bumper standard yet, but their headlight standards are different. And there's a
lot of speeds, bumper standard, might well forget it.
That's right, they don't believe in that. When you park a car in Germany, and you know it's going to be a tight call, and pedestrians walking their dogs, they will stop and look at. They won't help you,
mm-hmm,
but they will watch to see, and they will chew you out and shake their umbrellas if you touch somebody else's bumper. So cars just don't have damaged bumpers. You know, it's a different society, different mentality.
Yeah.
The other highlight of the career would be the Corvette 68. And a 70.5 Camaro. Those are, in their time, equally as exciting.
Yeah. Well, you've been there 6 years, and you've, along with the excitement of having a almost a complete new vehicle to work with, what else stands out in your mind? And the Russell Hendrix.
Well, we did some show cars too that were very interesting.
We did a European show car.
Yes.
Shows.
Yeah, we did one called the GT2, where we took a front-engine vehicle and we took it in the back room. We cut the engine out of it and moved it back about a foot and a half. So it was a front-engine, mid-engine vehicle with the engine right here, sliding doors on it, and a lot of innovation. And that kind of brought us a lot of good design, Opel design publicity. It was written up in several magazines, so the designers at Opel were very proud of that because they had their own German sports car on the show circuit. And it was a running vehicle. We made it run. We took it out to the proving grounds, and everybody brought their families out on a weekend, and we had a picnic out there at the proving grounds and just ran it around, which is, you couldn't do it here, liability and everything else.
Right.
But it worked out fine. I was excited.
Any innovations in that car later incorporated?
Well, yes, yeah, some design variation, design details. We did a different thing where we increased the dimensions of the gaps in the vehicle and made them a part of the design. In other words, where the roof panel joined the side door, we increased that dimension and made it a visible rain gutter, and lined up with all the moldings. So I see that happening in some vehicles, but not carried out to the fullest.
Uh-huh.
On a sliding door, we had a released door handle in the rearview mirror underneath. So you just squeeze it underneath. I've seen that on another couple show cars, but I don't think it's reached production yet, because as long as you don't have sliding doors, you don't need that. Oh, there were a lot of innovations. I think it didn't reach production. The innovations didn't reach production. It lent Opel an image of ability to do something more than bread and butter cars, and that's what it was all about.
Yeah.
And it was not in the idiom of Detroit show cars either.
Yes.
In fact, a lot of people didn't like it. Our management was not really fond of it.
You mean your urban management?
No, they were wild about it, but
okay.
our management back in Detroit.
Still a bit state conservative this period.
Yeah, the younger designers loved it out here in Detroit.
Well,
they loved it because it was an expression from Europe.
Yeah. Was there someone, Ford has some legendary figure, most legend making, most of his own doing, long time resident designer engineer named Uwe Bonson.
Yes, right, I know him.
Great charisma. Was there someone in the Opel organization that sort of paralleled his career? Someone you depended upon?
No.
There to give you direction?
No. The thing was, we were the counterpart of Uwe Bonson. But Uwe Bonson and the Ford organization is stable European. We were, all of our directors phase in and out. And there's stability there. It's a different sort of setup. The most stability we have is in an American called George Galyon. I don't know if you know him. He was my assistant in Chevy 3 studio for a while. And his wife, he married a gal who was with Lufthansa. She was German descent, Lufthansa. They got married. He's from Georgia Tech. And he had an assignment in Opel. Now, that assignment started about 12, 15 years ago, and he's still there. He doesn't want a promotion.
He likes it there.
Oh, yeah, she's German, and he speaks German fluently. His culture is German now. Yes. And his children have grown up. Ironically, his son, who's German, speaks German, is going to school in Arizona now, college. And he and his live-in girlfriend go to the beach down here in Malibu maybe once a month on a weekend. So he says, if you ever see anybody at your door needing money and it's Galyon, it's mine. G-A-L-L-I-O-N. George Galyon is a very, very creative person, stabilizing influence there. He understands the German culture, European culture. He understands the U.S. culture. He's a very big aid there, and the best anybody can do when you get there, you should listen to him and the Germans, and then make up your mind, because you're throwing something away if you don't.
How does the Vauxhall situation fit in with the Rüsselheim situation? Is it an appendage, or is it part of the?
No, they're responsible for European commercial vehicle design. And Opel is responsible for the passenger car design. So Opel really does the vehicles, and then they may do some badges or something like that. The Carlton is the equivalent of the Senator.
I see.
Or Record, I guess. And
Right. The setup is beginning to gel. There's been a lot of financial input, a lot of executive input from Detroit in the European.
Yeah.
The last 5 years, they really had to catch up.
Yeah, right. They have.
Is that working?
Yeah, and the product and everything is catching on. It's doing well. They've increased market share considerably, at the expense of some detractors at Ford say that GM is buying the market. I don't know if that's entirely true.
Well, Ford does the same thing.
Yeah. It's a very tough market over there. One percentage point can make it or break it for leadership.
People are the people you're partying
with. Yeah, right.
If you impress them, you give them a bit of discounts,
they'll come. Yeah.
Well, you obviously were very happy there, but about 1980,
yeah.
They decided to bring you back.
What, right.
How was that?
Entry is very difficult back again because you're used to doing things your way. You get a little, I suppose you become autocratic in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Entry was difficult because you had to re-enter into a gigantic system again.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to relearn the system. In other words, before you move, you have to check, now, before I do this, that person ought to know this, that, and that. So, you know, you instead of dealing with one or two people, you're dealing with about 10.
Mm-hmm.
And to do things right, it takes a lot more time.
It had grown enormously.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can't say it had grown enormously. The position that I was then promoted to, assistant executive designer in charge of Chevrolet and Pontiac studios.
Full executive.
Yeah,
top.
Right. Well, let's see.
How does it work?
Chuck Jordan is director of design there. Under him was, when I was there, Humbert, who since passed away. He got leukemia, Jack Humbert. And I was one of his assistants. He had two assistants.
At what studio was
that? Well, he was in charge of all North American passenger car, the position that that Dave Holds occupies now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
you're one of his two assistants?
Yeah, one of Jack's.
Yeah.
I was in charge of Chevy Pontiac, and Stan Weiland, the other assistant, was a Buick Olds and Cadillac. Altogether, we had, I think it was 5 studios each that we tended to and kind of made work. It's more of an executive position to try to guide the thing, or assistant exec to try to make sure that there's differentiation and make sure the designs come off. So you didn't draw as much as you directed. Some people feel on a side that may be too many layers of management. And after Opel, certainly it was cumbersome to work in.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. You had to fight your way through 2 layers to get to the final decision.
Yeah, and yet there is a need to try to do that because the workload is horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
Over 30 studios back there, and the heavy work is in a production area, so you really had to get a hold of it.
So your duties were to oversee those 2 studios?
Yeah, well, there are 5 studios, really. Two groups, but so like Chevy 1, 2, and 3, and Pontiac 1 and 2. One of the highlights of that time was when I came back, it was difficult after being in Europe and recognizing the European trends and seeing them happen out here. And since my parents lived out in California, I visited here every year anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what a different audience you have here than in Detroit. And to see all the foreign cars here is simply devastating to GM person.
Yeah.
So in re-entering that culture back there and working with GM back there, the disturbing part was that how could you bring what you've learned from Germany in without offending anybody who might have wanted to go and who hadn't had the chance? Well, an opportunity surfaced when Bill Hoagland, H-O-G-L-A-N-D.
H-O-A-G-L.
Yeah, H-O-G. H, no.
H-O-G.
Yeah, Hoagland, yeah. H-O-G-L-U-A-N-D or L-A-N-D. Was running Pontiac. and Pontiac sales are abysmal.
He's running the division.
Yes, right. General manager, vice president.
Right.
And he got an off-site seminar going with J.D. Powers and the chief designers and the engineers and myself. And
J.D. Powers?
He's a consultant that's right here in Westlake.
Mm.
And but he watches the market and tells it where it's going and what to look out for. And he was asked to give an account of what he felt Pontiac was doing and where it was. And it was devastating.
Was it?
I said that he just about said, you have no future. So then Hoagland blocked in where they were on an x-axis chart.
Mm-hmm.
We were all over the place.
What year is this?
This is 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And he allowed us to participate, just like Opel. Mm-hmm. And this is great, because
mm-hmm.
into that, we surfaced and we said, well, we have five divisions, and each one is competing with itself. And what you'd like to do is cut out a market segment for Pontiac, identify what it is and where you want to be on that thing. This is Hoagland speaking. And
yeah.
And we're able to do that. And right now, Pontiac really has a clear image of its vehicles, the Grand Ams with the spoilers, et cetera, and the Fiero. And it's very clear, and that's helped. But it's taken several years to turn around.
How about the design of it? What part did you play in that?
I worked very closely with Terry Henline, John Chinella. Terry Henline, H-E-N-L-I-N-E. He's in charge of Pontiac 2,
mm-hmm.
Grand Am, and the larger Pontiacs.
Mm-hmm.
And John Chinella, S-C-H-I-N-E-L-L-A. He's a counterpart to Jerry Palmer.
Oh, yes.
Who's in Chevy 2.
Right.
Or Chevy 3 now, that's right.
Yeah.
And Don Lasky, L-A-S-K-Y, who's with Chevy One. And Ruzzin, R-U-Z-Z-I-N, who's in Chevy Two. Have to come back.
So those were your cadre of,
yeah.
of designers working directly under you, and
right.
you directed them.
Right. Within the restraints of the overall system,
yeah.
budget, cost, and everything kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But they deserve the credit for doing all the work. You know, Palmer did a magnificent job on the Corvette. I came in on the last third of that development, watch it through the prototype stage, and now we're into the future Corsicas and Berettas and the W cars. So
yeah.
there was a lot of work there that
yeah.
that I hoped I could influence, so we'd get away from the Baroque, what I consider Baroque school of design, as something more meaningful.
The Fiero has been a great success story, in spite of its being underpowered.
Yeah.
But as far as the image goes, you've carved out a whole new image.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, that was put together by an engineer. I think it was Hulke Aldecati, and don't ask me how to spell that.
Try.
And Ron Hill, again. Who did the his studio design-wise did the initial concept, and then was passed on to Chinella's studio for production.
Mm-hmm. There was no one man.
No.
Was responsible.
No. The design perhaps Ron Hill was a studio head in the advanced
yeah.
area.
Could anyone could
be that. Yeah. That vehicle it suffers from being underpowered, but probably overproduced. You know, they've upped the numbers that they're producing, and
yeah.
is there a market that big for two-passenger vehicles? That's the question.
Yeah.
So, that's been a very successful car.
How have sales been?
They've fallen off lately.
Yeah.
The saturation, really.
Has been reached.
Yeah.
yeah.
There's a lot of new competitors out there, the Toyota MR2, you know, the new Mazda RX-7.
Yeah.
So there's only so much that you can put in the marketplace. I think it's probably overproduction more than anything.
There was a conscious decision to underpower it, or at least not to power it.
Well,
what happened there?
The car was conceived as a commuter car.
Mm-hmm.
We have a Corvette.
Sure.
And that has a definite vintage,
yeah.
Image.
Yeah.
This car, although Chinella and all of us wanted to make it more than it was, had to be defined as a commuter car. That means inexpensive, a reasonable amount of power, and that was its mission. Now, as it's evolved, because of the facility for taking sheet metal or plastic panels and hanging them on and doing different designs inexpensively, The car has evolved, and then also being the pace car at Indianapolis, it's evolved from a commuter nose to a very Ferrari-like nose, and now the rear sail panels change into something else. So in spite of the corporation wanting it to be commuter car, it has evolved into an image of much more than that.
Right.
Now, initially, you couldn't sell a program unless you insisted that this is a commuter car, because if anybody said, well, it's closer towards sports performance, the people who search out the volumes would say, well, you're going to take so many away from Corvette, it hurts Corvette, and now you're going to hurt yourself because it's a smaller market. So it was a conscious strategy to place it in the commuter category.
And this evolving, you were gradually begun to
make
more power and make power options available where they weren't available.
Right. And a competition is there, so that tells you what has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just walk away
from it. So it was an evolutionary concept initially. I understand someone has said that look, we've got to have a ladies, a sport car that ladies can handle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one consideration for the empowering.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
affordable.
Affordable.
Yeah, right.
But the mid-engine concept was your first production mid-engine.
Yeah, because I guess a Corvair is rear engine, really. It hangs out farther.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Well, whose idea was to make mid-engine, or was it a production?
This was Hulke Aldakati. Aldikati, maybe. Hulke is Hulke,
okay.
I think.
That was his concept.
Yeah, he's an engineer, very proficient engineer.
What's his background?
Well, he owned a... I think he's worked at GM a long while, but I think he's owned his own engineering shop. And he's just one of those fellows that he can do everything.
What's his ethnic background? What is
that? I think it's Greek or Turkish.
Greek or Turkish.
Yeah. He's a tough guy. He's really good.
Mathematical polymath who...
Right. He still runs his own job shop on the outside, I think. I guess as long as it's not a conflict of interest.
Yeah,
and he's something else.
There was a time when Bill, when our air would call you and say, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah, right.
Well, what other successes are you proud of in this most recent era of production cars?
Well, this is a difficult thing because during my 3 years, I was 3 years there, we were going through a transition of putting together Sprint and the Isuzu Spectrum, Suzuki Sprint, and of course the NUMMI plant, Nova. Those cars, and Chuck Jordan followed those up in Germany, but still in Japan. But still a lot of work was done in the studios, future concepts for the evolution of the W program, the front wheel drive cars.
So there was a slight identity loss there, wasn't it?
As far as I'm concerned,
yeah.
When you get to be into a more of a managerial position, you have to make all those strings work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So and at that point, the guys on the line deserve the credit for putting that together.
Yeah. But I mean, also there was a slight identity loss in the Chevrolet area. They seem to be sort of
confusing
their
image, right.
And they got lost somewhere.
I think that their model lineup is tremendous right now. I think it's 11 different models.
Why did they change the job?
Yeah, it's now we're getting that together. And I just see in the paper where Royce. R-U-E-S-S, or...
Henry?
No, Lloyd.
Lloyd
Royce is going to rationalize some model lines, and that'll make it a lot easier on the dealers. And
what lines?
Model lines.
Okay, by rationalize
model? By eliminating a lot of models that aren't top sellers, because we put a lot of tooling money in that, we don't get a return on it.
It's one of General Motors' problems. They seem to have an incredible proliferation of model type lines.
Yeah.
Finally, they're beginning to recognize that they're saturated.
So. It appears that way.
Yeah.
You know, you're caught between the devil and the deep on that because we're geared to make an awful lot of volume.
Mm-hmm.
Runs of 200,000, 300,000, 400,000,
right.
But now the market calls for smaller runs of maybe 50,000 to 100,000.
Yeah.
So when you deproliferate, got to be careful because you're going to throw the baby out in the bathwater.
Right.
You know, you've got to be very careful.
What are the lines you're most proudest of? What are the models you're most proudest of in this last period?
Well, I think the Pontiac evolution and trying to rationalize what Pontiac's image is. Pontiac, to emphasize or recap where I was a few minutes ago, made a conscious effort to accept the fact that nobody is attacking that kind of Euro-American approach to vehicles. Really putting some money into the suspension and to dams and spoilers and things that are aerodynamic device that mean something, and then following up with a competent advertising policy to make that statement. What's good to know is when I was in Phoenix with Irv Rubicki about 2 months ago, there's a fleet owners or fleet dealers meeting, and every one of the divisions had to put on a pitch, and they're all worried about competition in the fleet business. It's very fierce because that means that they talk about residuals. Those
right.
are that's what your car is worth after you run it through a fleet. Everybody's worried except one guy. He's the guy that represented Pontiac. The used car market's going up and up, except for the Fiero.
Yeah.
But that's not a fleet vehicle anyway. That's right.
You still have the Parisian going to bring that.
That's right. So there's a good feeling in Pontiac that they have good direction. And I think in my capacity, that was satisfying because that's what I thought I could supply the most.
Yeah.
The designer should design, and at this time in my life, I should try to help direct a little more or get a little input into that.
This was perhaps before your time, but the original Grand Am was such a gorgeous automobile.
Yeah.
And there was a great gnashing of teeth when you decided to drop it. What happened?
I don't know. I don't know.
It
was beautiful.
The studio, remember it?
Yeah. Well, the guy would be Jack Humbert, but he's not with us anymore.
Oh, yeah. He was the one responsible.
Yeah.
For the,
right.
The
thing that we're trying to do, design-wise, and
yes.
I guess that's one thing we ought to talk about.
Exactly. Right.
And you probably heard this before. Whenever we do vehicles here, what we're trying to do, I think most competent designers want to give their cars some structure. They have to have good proportion so that there's a rememberable statement. When a car drives by, somebody remembers that looked good. They may not know why, but you know the proportion, a golden section, the Greek columns, it's all tied in it. There are some design reasons. Good proportions, detailing, and then the excitement and direction of the vehicle. And that calls for a complete vehicle, not just body design without engine. One of my pet sayings, if you will, is that you take the Ferrari engine out of a Ferrari and try to unload it on somebody, the body, you don't have a Ferrari. It's got to be a complete vehicle. So if you have some competent mechanicals, then you've got to really have some competent surface that means something. And too often, I think car designs, either they lift the brush too soon or else the brush stays on too long. There's a time when that all has to come off and you freeze it. And sometimes that's very early before committees get into it. And sometimes I've seen where committees do help it too. But there's a time for each kind of vehicle.
Would that be close to what we might call the Hank Hagen personal design philosophy?
Well, I guess so, yeah.
What would you add to that?
Well, I think that there has to be a certain amount of functionality. I guess it's probably, no, it even came before Bauhaus Germany. I think that there has to be a reason for a vehicle existing other than just marketing and pouring the car out to satisfy some copyright. I don't believe in that. You don't build a long-term image that way. You know, that's short-term buck. And I think there's too many vehicles on the road that are dealing in short term.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be more to it. The structure of a vehicle to the surface. You know, we're talking now about cars becoming rounder and softer, and that's great. But we can go too far too, and then the cars don't seem like there's any skeleton underneath.
Right.
They get soft and oozy and gushy, and it that's uncomfortable. So you got to walk the line with design, but you can't get there unless you know where you're going first.
In the time we have left, Mr. Hager, could you give us a peek into GM's Advanced Concept Center that you had here in California?
No, not at all.
let me put this way. Can you give us, in terms of an audience 10 years from now, without giving away any comment, the thrust of this, why it was established, and the thrust of your existence here?
We're here because I think in Detroit everybody recognizes that we all think alike. You go to work in the same kind of company cars. You drive a test car now and then, but you're in a kind of a frozen environment. What we're here for is, quote, another look, unquote. Many people do it different. Many corporations do it differently. They consign Giugiaro, Pininfarina. We do that too for other looks at how to do things. But the corporation felt that it was valuable to get where the trends start, not fads, but trends.
Right.
Whatever happens in California seems to happen 3 or 4 years hence in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So that's why we're here. Now, you design on location. You try to shoot a film on location. At Opel, we designed on location. The Japanese are designing on location here.
Right.
Now, it's wrong for GM to sit in Detroit and design for the future when the trends are right here. So I feel very strongly that this is the right place to be at this time for advanced work. We also, it's not just emotional assimilation, we're working with societal analysis groups. For instance, Security Pacific Bank has its own futurists that they pay to read and just issue a bulletin every couple of weeks on what's going to happen in the world in the year 2000.
That's really what you're doing here, is looking into the future.
Yes.
A long, hard look.
Now, we've refocused. We started going way out there in 2000, 2000 plus, and we had a full complement of engineers, structural, aerodynamic. We have gone through that phase, and now we're scaling back, and we're trying to do advanced cars 1998 to 2000, 2010, because what we see is that you can't get too far away from the market.